Yeah, so thanks, Adrian, David, and Fred for inviting me here. It's a wonderful place, and I have enjoyed the lectures a lot. Hopefully, this will be fun. So as David said, we are trying to combine theory and experiment in a field which is kind of rife with lots of hypotheses. And when I say we, it's these set of wonderful people, graduate students and postdocs, and these great collaborators in many parts of the world. And I'll try to point out, unfortunately, my collaborators' names appear in most of the slides at the bottom, and it's getting clipped. So my apologies to my collaborators. I'll try to point out who did what. So here is the role of hippocampus in learning and memory. So there are roughly four key hypotheses about what the hippocampus does in terms of learning and memory. And I'll try to roughly give you an idea of what we are trying to do, more or less sequentially. We probably won't go through all four. So as far as we go. So hypothesis number one is that hippocampal neurons fire in spatially selective fashion. For those of you who may not know, hippocampus is this region which is underneath neocortex. It is part of cortex. It's the old brain. If you take it out, you can't learn. You have a lot of learning and memory deficits. So in particular, those neurons fire spatially selectively has been found more than 40 years ago. And it is believed that that spatial selectivity of hippocampal neurons is what mediates navigation. So in the second part of the talk, I'll tell you that that actually, our results suggest that that's actually controversial and the answer may be more complex. Hypothesis number two is that those hippocampal memories are formed rapidly through synaptic plasticity in the hippocampus during experience. And I'll provide some very, in the first part, give you very quick summary of what we did a long time ago and new evidence that is emerging, suggesting that the NMDA and spike timing dependent plasticity can modify place cells. And that can lead to some form of sequence learning, temporal sequence, spatial sequence. It's a long story. Number three is that there are oscillations in hippocampus, and they are abundant, in particular theta oscillations, which are about 8 to 10 hertz. Those oscillations play a key role in generating the spike timing required for that kind of plasticity. And there's a lot of stuff there, and I'll spend a lot of time there. We suggest that the average firing rates generate the precise spike timing via rate-to-phase transformation, generate something called phase precession, which generates temporal sequences on short time scale, and then new stuff, that's where I'll focus on, which is calcium dynamics at a single spine. So this will be mostly, first part will be mostly experimental, this part will be almost entirely theoretical, and hopefully we'll combine all of them soon enough. And hypothesis number four is that the hippocampus transfers whatever it has learned, that information to the neocortex for long-term storage during sleep, particularly the slow wave sleep. And we heard about the up and down states in last week's talk by McCormick. That's where some of these things are supposed to occur. Based on our data, we suggest actually the opposite may be true. The hippocampus neocortex may be playing a role in erasing memories from hippocampus, thereby improving signal-to-noise ratio and behavioral learning. So we'll see how far we go. So, yeah. Yeah, this is absolutely, thanks for pointing that out. This is the ideas that I'm presenting are quite general, and we have written a bunch of papers about how several of these things, not this, but those things relate to other brain regions too, including one paper which I really foolishly wrote called Hippocampus to Primitive Visual Cortex. And what are the similarities in the structure of spatiotemporal receptive fields in hippocampus and in primary visual cortex? So if there is interest, I can switch tracks and we can go to that one. But so yeah, that's mathematically made more or less the same things apply to many different regions. So for the most of the talk, in fact, for all of the talks, I'm going to actually go away from navigation and I'm going to simplify. As David said, I did theoretical physics, so some of that remain. So I don't let the rats navigate in two dimensions. I make one-dimensional navigation. A relativistic massless particle. Not really, but still. So the rat has to navigate in all the tasks just in one dimension. So we implant a whole bunch of tetrodes. They live with those tetrodes. They use three techniques. One is, of course, implanting dozens of tetrodes. We can measure, I have measured up to 120 cells simultaneously. We can hold them for up to 3 months. I still don't know how to make sense of the data up to 3 months. Everything I'm going to tell you is about what happens in a matter of 1 hour. That took us about 10 years, so you know how long it'll take for 3 months. So the task is going to be purely one-dimensional task. It's too bad, this is really getting clipped. So this says hippocampus has a cognitive map of space, as suggested by O'Keefe and Dostrowski in 1973. So the task is always more or less some version of this. You don't have to pay attention. The rat runs on a track which is about a meter and a half long, which is pretty narrow, so he runs through the exact same region of space. We know that the place cells are very complex. They depend not only on where the rat is, but where he's looking, how fast he's going, his experience, environmental cues, smell, texture. So we want to basically do something like a behavioral clamp experiment. But we don't change anything in the maze. Everything is, as far as we can tell, fixed. And he gets a small piece of reward here. And there's a bit of LED on his head by which we can track his position with an accuracy of half a centimeter every 30 milliseconds. So each tiny white dot shows you where the rat is every 30 milliseconds with about that much accuracy. This is almost to scale. And then he has to go all the way to the other end, and then he gets another bit of reward. And if he goes halfway and turns around, he doesn't get anything. So that's his one-dimensional navigation. So that's his one-dimensional sequence. And when he does that, you get different cells active. So here's this pink neuron that's active more or less here. These are all the neurons in a region called CA1, which is more or less the output region of hippocampus. Funky thing about CA1 is that it has very little or no recurrent connections. So it's a natural simplification. We are going to look at input to output transformations, more or less a perceptron plus inhibition, which does a lot of interesting things. So this neuron fires pyramidal neuron. These are putative pyramidal neuron spikes more or less here. The other fires more or less here. Notice it can spike up to 60 hertz here, and then it can shut down completely. And he's looking around while he's eating, checking out the world, and then he runs and so on. And then there's the other track where he runs back and forth here. These are different colored neurons. Some neurons can have multiple place fields, as you can see, but most of them are position selective. Almost all the neurons, and we can quantify that. I will show you how to quantify how many have selectivity or not. These are not only position selective, they are also direction selective, which means that this neuron fires only when he goes to the place field this way. The track is really narrow. Still, when he goes exactly the same region of space the opposite way, there is no spiking. So these are position and direction selective neurons. It's also a sparse code. Neurons fire only about one-third of the environment on an average. And in any given environment, if you had the rat and you had 120 cells, out of 120 cells, maybe 30% of cells will spike in that environment. Out of those 30% of cells, maybe half of them will fire on the track. Most of them care only for the reward. So we have been focusing on place cells, but a lot may be going on which is different. There's a lot of background, but I'll skip that.
What fraction of the cells are direction sensitive?
Almost all, 80%. But it's a very long topic. Basically, it depends on the rat's behavior. If I put the rat on a task where the behavior is non-directional, direction selectivity goes way down. So it relates to behavior. Yeah. Yeah. There is some, but it's remarkably less, like hugely less. That's right. I don't understand it yet. There are several theories out there, some relating to his goal-directed behavior, some related to the input from the anterior dorsal nucleus, which projects to the hippocampus, and those inputs getting associated. Some relating to, I don't really know. It's an interesting question. We don't know yet. One of the things it's worth figuring out. Right. Anything else? Yeah. We don't know that. So it's another very long topic. The short answer is that if you put a rat in a world which is a cylinder with one cue card, which is white, everything else is black, You rotate the cue card, the place cells rotate with it. Then you turn off the light, the place cells remain where they were. So it's not just visual cues. Yeah?
So once they're trained to go back and forth, if you take away the reward, they're still doing a task?
They don't do the task. They don't do the task. That's one of the things I learned as a theoretician. If you don't give a reward, they don't care. At least I had a hard time getting them to do anything. In fact, we tried experiments where he has to go to one place and then come back, and he doesn't get a reward there but gets a reward to the other side. Even then, they become highly reluctant to do. So we had a hard time getting them to run on the maze without any rewards. But maybe there are other ways. Maybe you can zap the medial forebrain bundle, as people do, which also taps into reward circuit, but yeah? So one thing, the first thing we did long time ago, and this is the only part that I'm going to run through, because this is really old. But if there is interest, then I'll pause. This was shown by several people, Mark Raman-Sackman, B. and Poo, and many others, that an MDA-dependent plasticity also has a strong timing component. If the presynaptic neuron fires before the postsynaptic neuron, then the synaptic strength goes up, and that has to happen within about 10, 20 milliseconds. If the opposite happens, which is you make the postsynaptic neuron fire before the presynaptic neuron, that synaptic strength goes down. And we wanted to see what will be the effect of this spike timing dependent plasticity in the biophysical network. Yeah?
So this was done, let's see. B and Poo did this in culture.
That's right.
So B had a paper, mm-hmm. you actually sponsored it, showed that when there's dopamine on the cell, which will go up during a learning task, it's as though you added a positive component to the tumor. So you got, there was still an asymmetry.
Yeah.
Pre-post versus post-pre.
Yeah.
Okay, it was positive on both sides.
Yeah.
When you go through all your theories and everything,
yeah.
Does all that evaporate when you actually do things under conditions that would happen during real learning?
So that goes back to that question that, you know, do I get rid of how, what is the dopamine doing? What are the cells? So there's, it's a long story. No, it's a great question. So when the rat is running on the track, more than half the cells are active at the goal locations. In this world, and that's where the reward is. We are focusing on place cells when he's not at the goal locations. All the stuff I'm going to tell you about is when he's not at the goal location, unless we talk about sleep and sharp waves and so on.
That's the hypothesis going there in terms of the model. That it's only when he gets the reward, he sort of shuts his trigger.
Yeah. That's right. Absolutely, that's the caveat, and there is a reason why we are focusing on place cells when he's running only. The reason is that when the rat is at goal location, his behavior and the behavior, his brain state are very difficult to quantify. So hippocampus has several states. One is when he's running, there's a clear 8 hertz theta oscillation. As soon as he stops, two extra states at least come up, if not 3 or 4. One is theta oscillation frequencies reduces by a factor of half. So several LTP experiments that were done use theta frequency of about 4 to 5 hertz. Turns out when the rat runs, the frequency is 6 to 12 hertz. It's a factor of 2. So that bothers me to some extent because we are worried about timing, and factor of 2 can make a difference. Second thing is that interspersed with those theta oscillations, you have bursts of high-frequency activity called sharp wave ripples. And there you have non-spatially selective activity and all kinds of stuff goes on. So we decided to do this experiment where we know that the hippocampal state is the same. It is that theta oscillation. His behavior is not going through multiple things. Otherwise, we'll not be able to make sense of what's going on. But that's a great question, and I'm actually going to get to part 3, where we are going to look at that. Actually, the spike timing dependent plasticity, the key thing is the NMDA dependent plasticity, if we are interested in. That doesn't just depend on spike timing, also depends on spike rate. And you need a certain rate of stimulation to generate even spike timing dependent plasticity. We need a more general model, and I'm going to get to that. And that will get to the symmetric, asymmetric, and all that stuff. So that's the very last part. Yeah?
Yeah, the hippocampus is a rather complicated three-dimensional structure.
Yeah.
Horn. So where is the hippocampus?
These are all dorsal CA1.
Dorsal
CA1 only. So all the thing I'll talk about. We also done stuff in parietal cortex, prefrontal, and entorhinal cortex, and so on. But and CA3, dentate, blah, blah, but that's a separate story. Today, everything is dorsal CA1. Okay? So we'll get to that. So we want to see what will this do in a realistic network. As I mentioned, that the good thing is that biology has provided us with enormous simplification, which is biologically relevant, because if you take out CA1, animals have a lot of deficiencies in spatial tasks. Majority of the inputs to CA1 come from CA3. They also come from entorhinal, but this paper, it's really bad, it's getting clipped, was published in 2000, 10 years ago. At that time, we didn't know of grid cells, so we didn't put in that, but this thing will still work. We don't know if there is spike timing dependent plasticity from distal synapses to CA1, so we ignore entorhinal for the time being. And the idea simply is this, that when the rat runs from left to right, different CA3 cells are activated one after the other. Yellow synapses are synapses that are weak, red are synapses that are present. Typically, EPSPs are about half a millivolt from CA3 to CA1. So you need several coincident EPSPs to make CA1 active. I can always arrange these cells in the order in which they are activated. That's not the anatomical order. So these cells will be kind of, if I were to take a time-lapse picture, I have different cells, active one after the other. And if I were to draw a line from the middle, these cells are active before the postsynaptic neuron. These synapses will undergo LTP via spike time-independent plasticity. These will undergo LTD, because it's the opposite order, because the output neuron on average is active before the input neuron. I'm really running through this, so if this is really not understandable or something, I'll go back, because I want to get to the new things. So we did that with biophysical model, calcium dynamics, and so on. The synaptic, the prediction of the model was that if the current injection is like this, then after the synaptic currents after experience become spatially asymmetric like that, so that these synapses became strong, these became very strong, these became depotentiated, and nothing happened to this. And this is your one-dimensional navigation. So the cell starts to become active earlier. So every cell has a little bit of anticipation. Every cell starts to anticipate, based on past experience, where to go next to get the reward in this one dimension. And there's beautiful work done by Larry Abbott and Wolfram Gerstner and Kenny Blum showing that how rats can navigate with mechanisms like this even in two dimension. So they can solve the Morris-Waldau maze task. It is that those are great questions. This is a really, really simplified task, the simplified model. Every CA1 cell doesn't get input from indefinite number of CA3 cells, so that's number one. Number two is that this is a brief little epoch. This thing is valid within one theta cycle. This CA1 cell projects back to entorhinal, and that goes back to CA3. So this is not valid for indefinite period of time. Sorry? No. This is just the model still. This is just the after experience. This is before experience. Yeah, there are wiggles and there are interesting things there. You guys are good. So yeah, there are wiggles. And so it turns out that that has got to do with how homogeneous are place cells and how systematic his behavior is. And if you looked at those wiggles, keep your eyes on. There are wiggles further coming on, which should not be there, but they are there. They are interesting wiggles. Yeah. Yeah. You're not lost. You're anticipating with respect to your input. Your CA3 neurons are telling you where you are. Your CA1 neurons are telling you where you should go, one step ahead. So you have two representations. And this thing will work for multiple cycles. This can work in visual cortex, and there are old experiments of Barlow, which has something to it about speed-dependent movement and so on, but yeah. Basically, the bottom line is hippocampus is, in this version, not interested in only knowing where you are. You need to know where you're going. You need to know Q and Q dot if you want a Hamiltonian formulation. But that's another version. But yeah, we are going there too. You actually need to know acceleration too, but that gets even more interesting, and I'm not going to go there. Yeah. Yeah, great question. I'm not going to get into that. But yes, there is an optimal running speed. And actually, the answer to that is more complicated because hippocampal neurons' firing rate itself depends on running speed. So it's an interesting problem. And that relates to spike timing dependent plasticity itself, because it doesn't depend on spike timing alone, it depends on spike rate too. So we'll get to that at the very end. if we can. Okay? This is still data, this is still theory. Now you see more bumpiness because I have put in theta oscillations. As I told you, when the rat runs, there are theta oscillations. This is the activity in trial number one in the model. This is the activity in an arbitrarily labeled trial. We don't know how fast things should run. So each bumpiness is that, and this is just the mean firing rate of the output neuron. It is skewed because of adaptation. All pyramidal neurons have adaptation. We heard a lot about adaptation last week, so we had put that in. So as the rat goes from left to right, the first spike occurs early with learning with LTP of the spike timing dependent plasticity. Last occurs early due to LTD. Peak firing rate goes up due to the difference between the two. It's interesting, even though they are equal here, the peak firing rate still goes up. And that entire shape becomes asymmetric, which makes the theoretician and me very happy. You have some kind of symmetry breaking, although it's an obvious symmetry breaking. So does that happen in data? Yeah. That's right, but majority of the places are directional. And this actually plays a role, yeah, it's an interesting story of that this itself plays a role in our mind of generating the directionality via recurrent inhibition. So we'll get to that in part two to some extent. Yeah? This is the first piece of data. So not model, not Photoshop, real data. So these are the spikes in the first trial from the data that I showed you, one of the cells I showed you. Rat goes from left to right. These are spikes in trial number one. These are spikes after simply four or five trials, which is about at most a minute or so, depending on how motivated he is. And this is the firing rate, which is dividing the spikes by amount of time spent in each spatial bin. That's position, that's firing rate. And you see first spike in this cell moved back by about half a meter. Last spike in a very noisy fashion moved back, like in the model, because LTD cannot wipe out the synapse fully. Peak firing rate goes up and the shape becomes asymmetric. We also have this bumpiness of theta oscillation. And this happens across the population of cells. So based on this, we suggested that yes, these are extracellular measures, but we think that intracellularly, if you were to measure this activity, you will see that asymmetric ramp at the subthreshold level. The suprathreshold activity is just the tip of the iceberg with Poisson noise influence on top of it. So that was not the only model, though. There were other models too available. I wish I can do this better. These things are getting clipped, but still. So along, there was a later paper by Harris and Buzaki, actually appeared back to back with our paper. They suggested that actually the place cells get symmetric input, like that. And because of spike frequency adaptation, the cells cannot spike all the way through. They terminate spiking here, and hence the firing rate profile looks asymmetric. So there are a couple of tests we could do, which are interesting, but there was a more direct test, which is to measure the membrane potentials of cells directly. Well, while they are doing place cells, of course, it's easy said than done. We started doing whole cell recording in anesthetized animals and so on until recently. Yeah. Yeah, I know. I know. Yeah, there are many things with which this doesn't fit. This thing will give you asymmetry, which is a function of time, not space. But we have shown that asymmetry is a function of space, not time, and so on and so forth. But there was a more direct test that came out very recently, so which was done by Harvey and Tank. They put the mice in virtual reality, so whole cell was much easier, still difficult, and they measured the membrane potential. So, and that was beautiful. They found subthreshold asymmetry. There are about 8 or 10 cells, very pretty clear, 4, 5, 10 millivolt asymmetry. Beautiful thing is they said that this is the right explanation, not the one we have, but that's how things go. So properties of place cell plasticity. Firing rate of place cells across 200 cells from any rats. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Well, there are different kinds of spike frequency repetition, right? The mechanism that has been suggested is that the current injection is symmetric. And that's the suggestion mechanism. Now we can go into there are several other reasons too, as Peter, for example, suggested that place fields actually start out being symmetric. Then they become asymmetric. We also measured the spiking asymmetry. Trial to trial, there are fluctuations in asymmetry. Do the fluctuations in asymmetry relate to firing rate, in which case it will be adaptation, or the number of spikes or something, or they relate to how far the spikes are in space? Because that will be sampling the underlying distribution. Turns out it is overwhelmingly related to space rather than time. If it is related to adaptation, then if the same cell were active in one environment where it became asymmetric, I put the rat in a different environment, 10% of cells are active in two environments, the cell should still be asymmetric because it's been adapted, some currents have built up and so on. Asymmetry actually resets. And then it becomes again asymmetric. So there are a host of other reasons too. But you're right. If there is strong enough adaptation, it can do some of these things. She's first, sorry, hold on. Yeah. No. That's a good point. They were actually measured the spike. They just showed the membrane potential. They didn't block currents, no. So they kind of deleted the spikes when computing this. And the firing rates are not too high. So this asymmetry is not so heavily contributed to spikes. Actually, they measured the asymmetry of spikes and found the asymmetry of spikes was very weak, which is, of course, makes sense because of adaptation. So what we say, at least in our simulations, when put in biophysical level of adaptation, the adaptation reduces the asymmetry, makes the cells more positively skewed, which is consistent with this, which means making the other way rather than this way. Yeah. What is gray and black? That's supposed to be standard error. Black is the mean. Okay? Or 95%. Sorry? It's supposed to be like that. It's significantly asymmetric. This way, they're all going this way. It goes up and then comes down. This is the place field 0 to 1. There is no shift here. They didn't measure experience dependence. They measured, they were well-trained mice, so there was no first lap and 20th lap and so on. This is just the average place field, average across many laps, and this is just the average representation, showing that this is asymmetric or ramping depolarization. Okay? So properties of this phenomenon, firing rate of place cells doubles within a few traversals of an environment. Place fields become more anticipatory, they shift backwards. Later experiments have shown this thing happens even in CA3, so this is not restricted to CA1, but there are differences and similarities. Happens even in head direction system. When the rat keeps running in a circular maze, the cells keep shifting backward as a function of angle, those head direction cells. So this is a general mechanism as suggested by many, including us. Place field shape becomes very asymmetric in a direction which are negatively skewed in the direction in which they are moving. Asymmetric receptive fields, especially spatiotemporal receptive fields, are found in many, many brain regions. You find primary visual cortex, layer 4, direction selective cells, they have more or less firing rates like that. You find auditory cortex, spectrotemporal receptive field, they have shift like that, and so on and so forth. So it's, I think, a reasonably general phenomenon, has been induced even in optic tectum. You move stimuli like that, you can generate asymmetric activity in there, shown by Engert and Poo. This is environment specific, as I mentioned. If I transfer the rat to a different environment, this doesn't transfer. This is an NMDA dependent. If you give an NMDA antagonist, the temporal, just a shot, block it throughout the animal's body, including spinal cord where they are there. So you have to adjust the dose properly, otherwise they have ataxia. It blocks these things. So we conclude that this provides perhaps an evidence for STDP during behavior and due to behavior. And we can use it for studying a whole lot of things and so on. But it raises one very big question, which has been bothering us for the longest time, which is that you give an NMDA antagonist to an animal, place cells are still there. So where does spatial selectivity come from? Learning goes away, that's right. You give an NMDA antagonist and you do behavioral tests, which are related to hippocampal dependent tests and so on, learning goes away. You can infuse an NMDA antagonist. Yeah, that's right. Place will shift. All the phenomena that I described above, they go away if you block an NMDA antagonist. I mean, block an NMDA receptors via CPP.
I mean, if you go into a new environment, like you say, in the first rehearsal, there is very little in the way of
Great question. So these things, good point. These phenomena that I mentioned don't occur on the very first day alone. They occur every single day. So that's part four of what I was going to say, which is that place cell plasticity occurs every single day, even in a familiar environment. And when the rat goes to sleep, that place field asymmetry goes away. Because 80% of place cells are asymmetric. So even if you could argue with me it's not the same cell the next day, whatever else it is, when the rat comes to the same environment the next day, and the only thing he does in his life is to be in his cage and run on this linear track, place cell asymmetry is more or less gone. And it repeats once again the next day.
But what about the very emergence of place cells?
That's a very good point. So one possibility is that, you know, you have been to the environment before, you formed the map, and you don't need NMDA receptors. Turns out that you have transgenic mice where NMDA receptors are blocked from development. Still, there are place cells, and they're pretty much more or less like the place cells in wild-type mice. They're 20% bigger. So. That's right. So two answers. So these phenomena that we show, this place cell plasticity, in our hands at least, it is pretty similar in familiar and novel environment. So not only do these things happen, there are many, many additional things, but some cells we don't fire any spikes start to fire robustly, which we think is because other cells are increasing the fire.
The thing I'm trying to get a clear answer to is the very emergence of place cell activity. My understanding has been that it's not.
Yeah. No. In our hands, so here is the key thing. People have suggested that when you go to a novel environment, the place spatial selectivity is poor, and it takes 10 minutes to develop. The problem is that when you put a rat in a novel environment, the first thing the rat says, what the hell? He doesn't run. He freaks out and he just freezes. When he freezes, he has sharp wave ripples. When there are sharp wave ripples, there's a lot of random activity which is not spatially selective. So you need to do that experiment where the rat's behavior is exactly the same. He's running at the same speed in the novel environment. He's in the theta oscillation. We don't know what the ripples do, so we are going to stay away from that. We did that experiment where we trained the animal to run an H-shaped task. In the middle arm, we blocked off, so he kept going on one circle. Other side of the room, he had never seen. We lifted, he went there. He still kept running, but the visual cues were different. In that condition, where the behavior was the same, the same phenomena occurred, which means place cells emerged. Some cells didn't fire anything for first few trials. Then they spiked robustly. They shifted backwards, all that stuff. It was similar.
Now, if you put an
NMDA in there, that's right.
What happens to that emergence?
It's pretty much equally messed up, which means that these things don't. The place fields are more or less equally there. If the rat is in a novel environment or in a familiar environment, you give an NMDA antagonist, the number of place fields that appear and so on is more or less the same. Yeah, that's right. Some place fields do. Some place fields take a little while to appear. And there have been experiments which claim, for example, I know you are rearing to go, there have been experiments which looked at this and claimed that there are more new place fields that come up in a novel environment. Speed needed to be controlled. Because speed has a huge influence on firing rate and so on. That's fine. Yeah. These are systemic. It's an IP injection, so it goes everywhere. That's right. It goes everywhere.
And so you would say that the sort of rate of appearance of place cells in a new environment is the same without
anywhere. No. Oh, that I didn't say that. No. There are multiple comparisons. I'm saying that the rate of appearance of new place cells in a novel and familiar environment is the same. Both with NMDA blockers and without NMDA blockers.
Okay,
so two-way comparisons first.
Right, so there you're
that's right. And you can also.
NMDA versus
this I don't know. So that answer I don't know, because that's complicated. It's got to do with rat's behavior getting altered. You give an NMDA antagonist, especially the kind of antagonist that we are giving, rat's behavior gets messed up.
Okay, but so your statement
What I'm saying is this, so if I give NMD antagonists systemically, put the rat in a novel environment, place cells do appear. This is difficult because, again, as I said, I don't want to put my neck, my foot down on that because his behavior is altered. So I don't want to say yes, they are or not. No, that doesn't happen. No. Perhaps, but I about as many, that's right. And there is a much more controlled experiment available, which is what I want to emphasize on, which is transgenic animals, where they silence the NMD receptors only between CA3 and CA1, which was from several labs, okay? So what I want to focus on is, and I'll show you the data, what I want to focus on is that instead of studying these neurons as point neurons, maybe we have to have the theoretician's nightmare to look at hippocampus in all its ugly glory. So it's not just, even though CA1 is recurrent, it has all kinds of inputs, and we summarize all kinds of stuff that is going on there. There are proximal synapses and distal. Some of them are perforated, some of them are not perforated. There are different kinds of interneurons, CA3, CA1. There are different firing rates. This thing more or less summarizes a fair amount of knowledge that we have. One thing I want to take away from this, well, two things. One is that even though number of inhibitor neurons are far fewer, if at any given moment, when the rat is running on the track, I estimated the total number of inhibitory spikes and total number of excitatory spikes, there'll be at least two times as many inhibitory spikes within CA1 as the total number of CA3 and entorhinal cortical spikes combined. So it's heavily inhibition dominated. And inhibition being on the soma and so on is going to do really funky things too. So it's really inhibition dominated. So there's real ideas of average mean firing rates and so on that are going to get in a bit of trouble. And this is going to play some interesting role, and I'm going to push that actually place cells arise by something called winner-take-all mechanism, which is permitted by inhibition, and distal dendritic synapses have something to do with it. So distal synapses, of course, there are two types. Distal synapses from entorhinal to CA1, CA3 to CA1. We want to look at, perhaps more interestingly, what about the distribution of CA3 to CA1 synapses, which are proximal and distal as well, in roughly that region. A fair number of studies have been done, LTP studies on mostly proximal synapses. What about the distal ones? We don't know too many of these things, but still. So here is the problem for this part number two, which is, what generates spatial selectivity in CA1? So most studies on synaptic basis of hippocampal function have focused on NMDA receptor-dependent plasticity, including us, of course. Systemic or genetic silencing of hippocampal NMDA receptors does not abolish spatial selectivity. So even when they are transgenic mice, where NMDA receptors were abolished right from the beginning in CA1 completely, spatial selectivity increased just by about 20%, which is not so bad, given that it's a sparse code. And the animals were actually messed up on the navigational task. So you have the opposite now. And you could say, well, place cells were there, but the place cells needed to learn, and the learning of the place cell or plasticity was messed up. But, yeah. We don't know that. Good question. We don't know that. There was an experiment from Susumu Tonegawa's lab where they silence NMD receptors within CA3. They found that spatial selectivity was more or less good, but what happened is that when they degraded the stimuli, the places degraded more. But I think that is too difficult for me to follow, so I'm going to just stick to when everything is left the same. Because I don't know where the degradation of environment does and so on. But those guys were actually okay with navigation in blocked NMDA receptors in CA3. So I'm just going to be blind to everything outside CA1, because it'll take too long. I'm temporarily blind. Yeah? But what about contribution of AMPA receptors and inhibition on spatial selectivity? So about 6 years ago, maybe 7 years ago, we took on these mice, which have different names. These are called GluR1 receptor on this side and GluA1 receptor on the other side, in collaboration with Peter Seeburg and Ralph Sprengel, who his postdoc, who generated these mice. These receptors are knocked out. originally the idea was that these receptors are going to play a role in insertion of AMPA receptors, trafficking during LTP induction, plasticity will be messed up. Turned out that was not true, and that is a whole different story that I don't know about. Perhaps these are the most well-studied mice as far as protocols of LTP are concerned, because what was found was that two different protocols, theta burst plasticity, which is kind of the stuff that happens when he runs, and spike timing dependent plasticity, are actually intact in these mice in hippocampus, that is CA3 to CA1, and in neocortex, which is basal cortex. So even though AMPA receptor trafficking, which these guys are mediating, was messed up, plasticity is intact. For interesting reasons, which we'll not get into, but here is a nice animal for us where plasticity is intact, especially the plasticity of the types that we are interested in, which is STDP and theta burst plasticity. We don't care for other forms because they occur perhaps at goal locations. We are not studying goal locations and so on. But it was found by Jeff McGee and his student, Andres Fowley, that there is a large reduction in the distal CA3 to CA1 synapses in these mice, whereas proximal synaptic strengths are left intact. So the dendritic distance-dependent synaptic scaling is messed up in these mice. So I'll show you a bit of data to show. But this provides us with a very interesting opportunity as to what are the contributions of distal dendritic AMPA receptor-dependent synapses and on inhibition on hippocampal spatiotemporal dynamics. Yeah? Coming to that. I'm coming to that. On some tasks, yes, on other tasks, no. I'll quickly show you that. So hold on. Yeah. Two reasons. So I'm going to tell you that those are the two mechanisms that we have not paid attention to as far as theories of place cell formation are concerned. AMPA receptors also appear on inhibitory neurons. AMPA receptors of this, the AMPA receptor transmission is messed up not only on the distal dendritic synapses, but also on inhibitory interneurons of certain types. We don't know too much about it, but we know that some of it is messed up. So those are the two things that have happened. Okay? Yeah. Yeah. That's right. I would rather skirt the whole issue because, as I said, they were supposed to play a role in trafficking of AMPA receptor. There was a silent synapse hypothesis that when LTP is induced, the GluR1 receptors are supposed to play a role in trafficking of AMPA receptors, endo and exocytosis, and that's how LTP and LTD are supposed to occur. That's right. I'm coming to that. That's right, there are many AMPA receptors. These are one of them. So this was a bit of a surprise. They were supposed to have altered LTP, and everything else was supposed to be okay. That didn't happen. And we are coming to that, that it is, transmission is altered, but it's at a different part. It's in a dendritically interesting way. Did I see any other hands? Yeah. There are basal dendrites as well. We don't know what happens on basal dendrites. Clueless. So we are going to focus only on the apical ones. And even in the apical ones, the data we have so far of the scaling goes only up to the most distal CA3 synapse. It's not obvious that it occurs for the entorhinal synapses because there are things like perforated synapses, and I don't know how that works. So bottom line, we don't know if it occurs anywhere else. We're going to assume that it occurs in CA3, CA1, definitely. We don't know if anything else also occurs, but I think the so-called theory we are going to push will be more or less robust to those things, if we did include other things. Yeah? So this is the data from these people's lab in way back. Here's the deal, and actually it was funny, I was actually unaware till some student at Society for Neuroscience meeting pointed out to me, saying, hey, do you know this paper? And I said, wow. So it's a good thing to go to these meetings. If you are clueless like me. So here is the experiment they did. This is the summary. This is how far they go, proximal or distal. What they find is that the miniature EPSC amplitude at the distal synapses in wild-type mice are about twice as much as the proximal synaptic input, but in the knockout, the distal synapses are much weaker, proximal synapses are more or less the same amplitude. Yeah?
Did they find any compensatory mechanism?
This is a global knockout. The claim is that these receptors are mostly localized in the forebrain. So there could be compensatory mechanisms too, but this is now the functional thing. At the end, this is happening in these mice. Yeah. Not to my knowledge. They looked, actually. So they looked for plasticity, and they looked for the AMPA transmission. These are the two things. I don't know what else they could look for. They did not look at it, but it is known that if these kind of AMPA receptors are present on inhibitory neuron synapses. So GABAergic neurons in CA1 do have these synapses. So the model that I'm going to describe assumes that those two things occurred. This happened and the other one occurred too. But there's no direct evidence that the second thing occurred. But it seems like that should occur. Okay. So we are going to put that in. So here is the behavioral deficit in these mice. It's a complicated slide. This is summary from the research of several people. Don't look at those things very quickly. If you do sham lesion, this is the Morris Watermaze task, the standard Morris Watermaze task. If you take out the entire hippocampus or just the dorsal hippocampus, rats and mice, are rats here and mice here, are impaired on the Morris Watermaze task, this exact version of Morris Watermaze task, because there are many versions of it. So we have to be careful that it's the same lab, same version. So if you take out hippocampus, rats and mice are impaired on a certain version of Morris Watermaze task, but these knockout mice do as well as the wild-type mice on that same hippocampus-dependent task. So to summarize, on the Morris Watermaze task, if you take out hippocampus, mice cannot do that task. But if you knock out GluR-A receptors, they can do that task. So this is something that is not messed up, which is the first thing we would have expected. And you could say, well, these mice have decent LTP. Why not? They should be able to do a task. NMDA receptors are intact. Theta burst LTP and STDP are intact. Sure, they should be able to do the task. So that's one possible answer. Turns out they're actually messed up on a different task, which is spatial working memory task. So it's still a spatial task, but he has to remember that he's rewarded on like three arms, this, this, and this, but not on the negative ones. If he has to just remember these three arms are rewarded, he can do that fine. But if he has to remember that he has to go to these arms only once, the rat is messed up. This is called spatial working memory. So there are two kinds of, there are many, many names of this taxonomy. There are two kinds of spatial tasks, roughly. Spatial reference memory, where you have to remember one thing and go there. Spatial working memory, where you have to keep track of different things. They are messed up when they have to keep track of more than one position. They are okay when they have to go to one place, even though it can be very complex in two dimensions and so on. Okay? So in this task, they are massive. In the other task, okay, so what happens to place cells in these mice when these receptors are messed up? So that's the same data format. I have changed the slightly format. So the mice are run on the same size track, same task running back and forth, gets a reward here. We're going to not look at cells which are active at the goal locations, but near this cell. The red dot is where the cell spikes a lot. This is the heat map showing you where the firing rate is. The color depicts the firing rate on that little segment of data. These are the clusters showing you our data. Clustering quality was good, otherwise you can always get crummy cells and so on. This roughly shows you direction selectivity, what direction cell fired, this cell fired in outward direction.
That sounds very close to the goal.
Yeah, yeah, here, we're coming to that. It's just the position, it's just the whole place. It's the whole track, so that entire region, firing rate in that entire region, two-dimensional region. So this, the blue trace here, this is X in space, this is Y in space, and color is the rate. Okay. This is one cell in the knockout running more or less the same. We can quantify the behavior reasonably well because they are doing this. The running speed is more or less the same. But in this cell, the firing rate is pretty much gone. Its cell is spiking more or less everywhere. So spatial selectivity is pretty much gone. And that's, of course, one cell. Here are a whole group of wild-type cells. Sometimes you do get wild-type cells which have crummy or two or three place fields, even though they are well isolated. But that's well known. Although place fields could be a little crummier in mice, has been reported. But in knockout, this is pretty much gone. So these are a whole bunch of cells from different mice. Direction selectivity is also messed up almost completely. These are the directional polar plots. So sometimes you do get reasonable place field, but by and large, spatial selectivity is pretty much gone. Yeah, one sec. We are coming to that. It does, actually. It does. We are coming to that. It does. The mean firing rates are more or less the same. It is the peak firing rate where is the biggest decrement. About threefold reduction in the peak firing rate. But the mean firing rate is more or less the same. But we are going to go into that in really a lot of detail in a second. David.
So, I mean, you say place cells are destroyed. Okay, fine. The place cells are a burst of activity on us when you're made.
Yeah.
But then you say spatial selectivity is destroyed. But I don't think that's fair because
yeah. You
can say that each cell just has this.
That's right. Very good point. Yeah. Two more slides. I'm going to get to that. Let me quantify this first. These are just pictures. So I have to quantify this, and then I get to come to your point that maybe this crummy representation is still reproducible. That's right. You could still do pretty well. If it is reliable, you could still do well.
Right.
I'm going to show it is actually not even reliable. Okay. So we're going to quantify that. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so here is the deal that, so you want the punchline, right? How the hell? I give the punchline on the very first slide, remember? The funding sources. No, the second slide. So the answer is complex and controversial. So what we think is going on is this. We know that place cells are found in multiple brain regions, CA3, CA1, dentate, entorhinal, medial, entorhinal cortex. What we think is going on is that because perhaps space is so important, you need multiple representations. They may be doing different things and so on. If you take out hippocampus, the entorhinal cortex, which is the output of the hippocampus, which goes to the rest of the brain, which perhaps are making decisions about what to do, you need that CA1 activity at least to keep the entorhinal going. Otherwise, the entorhinal is not going to be active enough. So if you take out hippocampus, animals are messed up on this task. But if you have the hippocampus and hippocampus is doing garbage, then entorhinal activity is going to be messed up. That's why they are messed up on the working memory task. In addition, when the activity patterns are like this, cells, animals are going to be really messed up because all these anticipatory changes are going to be gone, which are actually occurring very rapidly, occurring within 3 or 4 trials. They are going to be gone. So that's going to mess up your working memory task. So that's the big picture. They can navigate just fine because that's training that's going on for a long time. Navigational task is not something that you do, even though in real world, as Ken was pointing out earlier, you come there to the room, you know where you are within about 2 seconds, maybe even less. But the way Morris Pomerantz-based task is done, they are trained for a long period of time. That's a different thing. That's right. So procedural memory could be related to the so-called spatial reference memory. There are different taxonomy which had. Don't really even know well enough. That's right. It could be that. So this allows us to at least dissociate those two things. But you're absolutely right. This is shocking, right? That there is a place, as far as I know, there's the largest deficit on spatial selectivity anybody has shown in hippocampus, but these guys can do the Morris water maze just fine. No, everything is fine. That was the previous slide that I ran through somewhere. It's all of that is here. They do more or less same time course and so on. These are all a bunch of different comparisons. The time spent in quadrant, all kinds of stuff is more or less the same.
So, do they learn?
No, all of that's right. Their learning rate is the same. If you have a probe trial, they do the same. How long they hang on before they say this is bad, also the same, so on and so forth. So let's just quickly quantify these things, and then we are going to come to this of how they may or may not be able to do. So I'm going to say that basically you don't need the spatial selectivity and so on. So it is going to push this even more. So first thing is, I told you the mean firing rate reduced at most by 20% between wild type and knockout. And fair amount of it can be explained by the fact that their running speed went down a little bit, about 10%. Not enough to explain these results. Notice x-axis is logarithmic, so peak firing rate reduced by a factor of 3, more or less, between wild type and knockout. Sparsity, which is more kind of independent measure, not based on one fact. Lambda I is the firing rate in a bin, I, L is the length of the track. Sparsity, fraction of the environment in which the cells are active, went up, which means cells were active in much larger fraction by about twofold in the knockout animals. Information content, notice this is bits per spike, I prefer that for whatever reasons, which is P is again probability of spiking in a certain bin, lambda bar is the mean firing rate. Information content went down by a factor of 3. Coherence, if the cell spiked in a given location, did it spike in a neighboring location too or not, which suggests how informative the cell might be. That went down by a factor of 2. Red is the knockout, blue is the wild type. Number of fields, I don't want to go too far into it because the activity patterns are so noisy, you have to put threshold and so on, so it's a nasty parameter. But we quantified that anyway with the standard characteristics. More place fields, about 2 times more. And signal to noise ratio, if the lambda S is the mean firing rate within a region called place field, one sec, and lambda N is the firing rate outside the place field, then signal to noise ratio again went much south in the knockout. So every measure that we could think of went down in these mice. Yeah?
Did you look at the correlation?
We could not. We tried the problem, that's why I prefer to work with rats. We can put in 12 tetrodes, 30 tetrodes, and we can get a lot of cells, and we can look at correlations. Mice are tiny, so we can't put that many tetrodes. We wanted to make sure that the behavior was not altered. So we went with really tiny drives. You saw the picture, they were like about 2 gram drives. So we could get, you know, in the place cells, very few are active on the maze, so we have about 10 cells which are coactive in the same region. Based on that, I can't tell you if the correlation changed. So just lack of data. Yeah? I will not necessarily, yeah. I'm not able, we look for that thing to see if it was significant, and I'm not able to claim that that's the case. Maybe if we had many more cells, we could claim that thing. But don't know, it's a good point. Yeah? Yes. I will not phase precession. I will not show you phase precession, and I will not show phase locking. A little bit of that I will show you. So let me give you the quick answer. The reason I cannot define phase precession thing is because to define phase precession, you need to define place field boundary. It's very hard to define place field boundary. So if we push around and say, well, the boundary is here, maybe there, then maybe the phase precession is intact. Use slightly different definition, it's gone. So I don't like that. So I can't tell you that thing. Phase locking actually has gone up in these mice. The theta phase locking is stronger. I cannot talk about the preferred phase of these cells because preferred phase depends on what the depth at which your electrode is. The theta phase reverses. So we got to be very careful. So we cannot talk about it unless they're all simultaneously recorded. You can't do that. Such claims have been made, but they, I think, are baseless because you got to be very careful when you assign theta phase. Otherwise, you'll get garbage. So, yeah? Absolutely. We are coming to that. Yep. So it's possible that even though individuals, as you pointed out, you don't need this much, right? In hippocampus, you have about 100,000 cells. If you have merely 50 cells and you merely counted the mean firing rate, not even a very fancy algorithm, with 50 cells, you can localize where you are in space. And plasticity is intact, they can do this, they have, you know, many more cells, so what's the big deal? And we did population vector reconstruction. Turns out that in these animals, and I have not put up the slides here, the population vector reconstruction shows you that 80% of the time, these guys are as accurate as the wild type. What do I mean by as accurate? 80% of the time, the reconstruction error is about within 10 centimeters, which is the size of the platform in the Morris-Waldau maze, true for wild type and knockout. But 20% of the time, the errors in the wild type go way off. Whereas in wild type, those rest of the errors are still within maybe 15 centimeters. In the knockout, those errors go like, I don't know, other end of the track or in the different direction of the journey. And we think that is why when they have to remember multiple places, they are messed up. But that's too science fiction-y for me. Sorry? There may be other things, that's right. That's the one we tried. That's the one. We tried that too, actually, and that gave similar result. We did maximum likelihood, yeah. But I'm not getting into that now. Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
So normally I think
you
just divide it up into four problems.
That's right.
And the red in the right
one.
So
that's right. That's wonderful. So I like to know, yeah, that's perfect. So I like to hear that one. That's exactly the direction we were going. That this enormous selectivity is about how fine a representation you have. And that this thing is messing up. So yeah, exactly. So that'll be a wonderful thing if it is published. We have done that. We haven't published it. As you can imagine, we submitted this paper a year and a half ago, but the referees just won't let it go. In some sense, this is destroying hippocampus as a cognitive map. Right? You have no place cell, and the mice are able to do the task. So it's just not getting published, but it'll come out someday, I'm sure, before next century. So let's start explaining this thing. How could this perhaps work? So the idea is pretty simple. It's a winner-take-all network. So here is the wild-type network. Here is a knockout network. You have these CA1 place fields. These are pyramidal neurons. These are inhibitory interneurons. They are recurrently connected to each other. These inhibitory interneurons are also connected to other pyramidal neurons, which is the standard anatomy. They get input from distal synapses and from proximal synapses, as shown by McGee and others. Distal synapses are much stronger than the proximal synapses in wild type. In the knockout, that is not true. In the knockout, distal synapses are as strong as this, so when you come to the soma, they become much weaker. Whereas in wild type, at the soma, all of them are more or less the same strength. Yeah. Here, I'm looking at only CA3 to CA1 distal versus proximal synapses. But otherwise, there are two sources, CA3 to CA1 and entorhinal to CA1. Those are the majority. Sorry? CA1 to CA1 is 1%. That is on the basal dendrites. So I'm going to be a theoretician for a little while and say, no, 1% I'm just going to ignore and say there's no recurrence. But it's not going to mess up things too much. But we are trying to solve those equations in mean field approximation to see if you put in 1%, will this work or not. It's interesting and pretty complex thing to try.
But Jeff probably measured the interval.
No, not to my knowledge.
No, when he said that he's got smaller distal, he was probably looking at interval.
No, it was in the paper they mentioned CA3. They went with 250 micrometer. That's in the paper.
I see, they weren't really distal.
No, not that distal. And there are debates in the literature about whether the entorhinal does show the scaling or not. I don't know even know if it has been demonstrated that synaptic scaling applies to entorhinal to CA1. So I'm not aware of any references. Anybody knows, we'll be happy.
And this was based on focal stimulation or
puffing? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. Actually, I don't remember, so I'm lying. So I have to look it up to tell you exactly what they did.
The picture you showed earlier.
Yes, I think so, but I just don't want, yeah, I just don't want, yeah, I just don't recall. It's been a long time since I read. That's right. I think they did it, but they could have done some other fancier things as well, flash and caging and so on. So I don't know that one. No, they could have done some uncaging of glutamates and so on, or some, but don't know that. So the idea is simply this, that in the normal animal, the bunch of CA3 cells, which is spatial selectivity. Those cells give random set of cells, give input to CA1 cell. Purely by chance, somewhere this CA1 cell gets a massive amount of input compared to all the other CA1 cells. So that cell fires robustly at that point. Because that cell fires robustly here, it drives inhibitory interneuron, which kills the activity of other cells at this point, so other cells die out. So it's basically lateral inhibition or winner take all. Vice versa happens here. At this point, this CA1 cell still gets some activity, but it is weak. But some other CA1 cell is getting a lot of activity, so this cell cannot spike. So this cell spikes more or less only here. Okay, so that's a simple thing. In the knockout, the total driving force itself is very low. Because the driving force itself is low, the inhibitory neuron is not driven enough, which in turn doesn't shut down the other cells. So we are doing simulations. I'm not going to show you this, but there are reasonably robust range of parameter ranges where this can be shown to occur in a network of excitatory inhibitory neurons with some integrated fire neurons, not multi-compartments. So we just assume the scale thing. Just we don't have the computing power to do that, nor do I want to do multi-compartment right now. So for the purpose of this talk, even though the results did occur because of scaling changes on the dendrite, all we're going to assume is the distribution of inputs has changed. That's all. We're still going to assume point neuron. There may be interesting dynamics about whether synapses are on dendrite, but we are just going to ignore that. So as a result, in the knockout, the cells are going to fire in multiple places. Because the winner take all is going to be impaired. As a result, the peak firing rate is going to go down, but the mean firing rate will remain more or less the same. Because these guys can fire a lot somewhere, but they'll shut down elsewhere, whereas these guys fire in multiple places, but they don't take off to high rates anywhere. Yeah? That's right. Maybe I didn't understand you. Now I thought I understood you, but now I don't know. Yeah. That's right, we don't, that's right. It is local, that's right. That's right. So in this case, we assume that the inhibitory neurons get similar random activity pattern, which based on biology we know. That inhibitory neurons get input from CA3 to CA1, which is more or less the same pattern. But inhibitory neurons, as we know, spike more or less everywhere. But they do have fluctuations in firing rate, which are significant, but they are not just totally focal. That's what data shows. Yeah?
I might have missed something, but I'm missing the logic here. Why does reducing the input to the result, besides your input to the result, and
the total amount, so in this version, we are assuming that even though it's distal synapses, the model that I'm thinking of is just a point neuron. So the net driving force has gone down. To the excitatory neuron has gone down, and the net driving force of the inhibitory neuron has also gone down, as well as the driving force of this excitatory neuron to inhibitory neuron has gone down. Because the AMPA-dependent synapses are present here and here, and there are two types of them. Okay? So the driving force from here to here will go down as well. It is known that the same AMPA receptors are present, and there are indirect studies showing that in these animals, the driving force on AMPA receptors has gone down, but not directly shown. So we don't have, That's right. But still, it is known that the net driving force on inhibitory neuron does go down. But the evidence is indirect. And I can go into that, why that's the case. But basically, these same receptors are found there. So we don't understand the mechanisms why the distal has gone down and not proximal and so on. But that's beyond me. That's right. That's right. That's right. So what we know is that if you take a different knockout, so that's the indirect thing which I didn't want to get into. If you take a different knockout where you make a double knockout, where you knock out the inhibitory synaptic blue array receptors only on the paravalbumin-containing inhibitory interneurons, then we know that those strands are gone. Suggesting that this, the driving force on inhibitor interneurons is reduced. But you could argue that when you've done generated double knockout, you might have done something else. So that's why I'm saying it's a bit indirect. They have the same similar deficits. Nobody has measured that. This is the only measurement we have so far. Yeah. I can't do that thing in my head, so I don't know. You clearly have some ideas of what that'll do, so we should talk about that. But yeah, it's in it. There are two things going on, as I said. One is the distal thing that has gone down. Other is this inhibitory driving force. We don't know. And the same thing can be said to all the NMDA knockout thing. That messes up transmission too. In fact, when you do NMDA-dependent knockout, you mesh up transmission and plasticity on excitatory neurons and inhibitory neurons. So this is as far as the tools that we have go. But, yeah. Yes. You could call it lateral inhibition. Yeah, we could call it lateral inhibition. But in the sense we called it remainder take all is that the cell gets more input, takes away completely, and it suppresses the activity of other cells. Whereas here, the activity is not suppressed fully. The cell spikes at multiple places. So that's the sense in which it is going to take off. Yeah?
So I assume if you assume here for a branch cell, a highly spatially dependent excitatory
subspecial? Not spatially. That's right. Each input is spatially selective, but the collection of them is not. It is random. We assume that the place fields in CA3 are intact. And if you don't like CA3, somewhere out in the world where neurons are responding to some stimuli, those inputs are intact.
Yeah.
But this is CA3 to CA1, but... That's right, because CA3 inputs, we believe, are actually intact. We believe CA3, we haven't measured it, but we assume that CA3 cells have spatial selectivity, and that spatial selectivity is intact. No. We don't assume that. We assume the same spatially random input to excitatory neuron and to inhibitory neuron, to both, which is consistent with the data. It is just that this winner-take-all, you can solve this matrix in such a way that these guys develop reasonable place fields, but the others don't. It can be, you can put in certain parameter space. Yeah. Yeah, something like that, because we know that it... Sorry? Now I don't think I understand your question. No, not really retinotopic, in the sense that there is no topography. These cells are getting input from somewhere. The cells which are getting input, they are not necessarily next to each other. Nearby cells, I don't require them to do similar things. That I don't require. I'm just saying the cell is getting certain inputs which is locked somewhere in space. But I'm here, I have a distinct set of inputs, I'm here, there are a distinct set of inputs, and they appear in some random way to each cell. So in this version, so we can, I don't know, maybe the name is confusing, maybe it should not be winner take all, it's something else, but that's a network. And that can do this. So I don't have the data here, but this we can put that into a realistic network. We can show that, solve it, and find the bounds and so on. So we can generate that. Anything else? So this can explain why the mean firing rate will be more or less the same, but the peak firing rate will reduce by a factor of like 2 or 3. And the spatial selectivity will go down, signal to noise ratio will go down, so on and so forth, because the cell will spike outside and all that stuff. But we also know that on top of these cells get theta rhythmic input as well. When the rat is running, we see that these cells get pretty strong theta rhythmic input. So what will be the result of the combination of theta rhythmic input and spatially selective activity? What's going to happen is that in the wild type, the firing, the net input is very high. So if the cell spikes on any theta cycle, it's not going to spike only at the trough of theta cycle, it can spike also at the peak. Not only that, if it spikes on one theta cycle, it'll spike on the next theta cycle as well. And if I looked at the interspike interval within a theta cycle, bursting, these cells will be able to spike at much higher frequency, or intraburst frequency, which means interspike intervals will be very small, because the driving force is very high. All that will be reversed in these cells. Because the net driving force has gone down, the very short interspike intervals here will be reduced. These cells will not only spike at the trough of theta, they will spike more or less at the trough of theta, not also at the peak, because the driving force is low. If the cell spiked on one theta cycle, there is no guarantee the cell will spike on the next theta cycle. Because the thetarhythmic inhibition may not just go down sufficiently enough in the next cycle. So the inhibition remains large and the cell spikes here, but not here. So this can start explaining a bunch of things and start making a bunch of other predictions. One is that the structure of bursts in these cells should go down. In a specific way, the very high frequency bursts should be reduced in these guys compared to this, but the slightly lower frequency bursts should be more prominent here. Second is that these cells will not spike on every theta cycle. They'll show something called theta cycle skipping, even though they are modulated and phase locked to theta oscillations. So we check that, and that turns out to be true. So this is the interspike interval on x-axis. The y-axis is probability density. Blue is the probability interspike interval distribution for wild type. Red is for knockout. The very short interspike intervals are gone. Intermediate are more. And there is theta cycle skipping, which is shown here by just the ratio of the probability density of spiking across all the cells. These little widgets show you the error bars between wild type and knockout. Pretty large increase in the very short interspike intervals in the wild type. Reduction, increase in the intermediate burst in the knockout. Large increase in spiking on adjacent theta cycle in wild type. Large increase in theta cycle skipping in the knockout. So you get this complementary behavior. So the temporal structure, too, can be explained by this simple mechanism. What more can we do? So what's going to happen now is that because these cells are now at the excitation is not large enough. So these cells are now at the mercy of inhibition. If in a given theta, given trial, the cell spiked here, in the next trial, the cell may not spike in the same place. So for example, here, in a given trial, the cell spiked here, but in the next trial, the thetarhythmic inhibition may not just go down sufficiently. And the cell will not spike here. Maybe it'll spike somewhere else. That's not going to be the case in the wild-type animals. In the wild-type, if the cell spiked here because the excitation is so high, in the next trial, too, the cell will spike more or less in the same region. Not necessarily, because LFP is not just one cell. It's a lot of cells. And if LFP amplitude, I don't know how to make sense of. Because it's LFP amplitude is difficult to compare across animals. But LFP frequency content, we can analyze, and we will. And that does change a lot. We're going to get to that. So we can talk about frequency, not amplitude. Okay? So what this is going to tell you is that these cells will be actually fluctuating from trial to trial. So the map, not only is the map poor in a given trial, the map is not going to be stable across trials. So that answers David's question here, that these cells are going to be actually, the map is actually not going to be stable. Because the map is not stable, even though theta burst LTP and STDP are intact, the pairing between pre and postsynaptic neurons will not occur reliably across trials. So this network, even though plasticity is intact, is not going to learn reliably. So systematic changes in these cells will be killed. If we tried that, we tried that and we are trying it, but as I said, the amplitude of LFP relating that to inhibition is a tricky business. There is no evidence that the amplitude of... Even if we do, I don't know if I can relate the amplitude of LFP to amount of inhibition. If at all, the LFP is supposed to be the net sum of EPSPs. I don't know if it provides me with a reliable estimate of amount of inhibition fluctuation. So we tried that, but I don't know if we can do it. Yeah. That's right. That's exactly right. We wanted to make sure that the task is such that it's the same thing. Otherwise, it's the behavior that's generating it. I think driving force will be big enough or not, because that's just the way the synapses are. So my view of the world is brain first, brain doing something to the behavior, rather than behavior. I don't know how it would be. If the animal was doing some hippocampus-dependent task, then I would know. I don't even know how to manipulate those, that somehow these results will either change. It's difficult for me to imagine that. But I don't know what cellular mechanism will suddenly start doing that. So we looked at that. So what this predicts is that you will have more trial-to-trial variability in these animals, but less systematic changes, suggesting that if we were to go with the hypothesis that with this remaining spatial selectivity, animals can still navigate, it will not work for two reasons. The maps are not going to be reliable from trial to trial, and the maps will not learn well with trial to trial because of the lack of reliability. So you will neither be able to have a reliable estimate of where you are across trials, nor will you be able to learn based on the experience. And that's what we show here. So you basically take the firing rate map in the second half of the trials versus the first half of the trials, compute the difference. This is both for knockout animal. You would think there is a lot of learning occurring, because in the second half, the firing rate is very different than the first half. But instead of that, if you simply looked at the even versus the odd trials, just like that, in that case, there is no temporal component, but still equal amount of fluctuation. So these changes have to be normalized by the changes across random trials. So systematic changes have to be normalized by variability. If you do the same thing for knockout, wild type, it's different, as advertised in the first part. For wild type, first half there is little spiking, last half there is more, but even in odd, there is much less change. So systematic changes are more, fluctuations are less, or variability is less in wild type, which is shown by this really complicated figure. These are so-called trial order correlations. These are trial shuffle correlations. It's basically showing you that when you do trial shuffle correlations, that's the variability. Smaller numbers means more variable, less correlation between those trials. In knockout, there is much more variability, but there is no systematic change when you normalize by the amount of fluctuation, by a pretty large amount. So zero significant change with experience in knockout. Significant change with experience in wild type. But a lot of increase in variability. So you have three problems with these place cells in knockout. Not only do they have much reduced spatial selectivity, they are much more variable, and they don't change with experience. Right, in the same condition, the wild-type cells do change, and they are much less variable. So to go with the argument that somehow the hippocampus, the mouse, can still do the task based on these cells, it's going to be difficult based on these results. About 20%. Or baseline. This is difficult for me to quantify. I don't know. Because for... this is not, that's just one cell. That's just one cell. If I quantify across, and these are not baseline. Baseline, oh, you mean this stuff. Yeah, but that's not baseline, that's just a spatial firing rate. Baseline, the way we would define is this firing rate when the rat is not on the maze. That's what I will call baseline. But this is the result, that the cells are spiking everywhere. So that's not baseline, that's just crummy firing. Sorry? That's a totally different thing. No. Cell is responding. These are place. This is on the maze. So this is a firing rate as a function of position. But that's a different story. We tried a couple of them. These are basically correlations, which are Pearson's correlation coefficient on only the pixels where at least on one of the bins was active. Rate maps. So compute the firing rate map of all the even trials, compute the firing rate map for all the odd trials, and take the vectors and compute the dot product. And then there are different ways of doing the dot product, whether you allow the firing rate to contribute or not, which are Pearson's versus different. So these are kind of things which are more stringent version. So the rate itself doesn't influence and so on. OK? And this is going back to your question. So if this is the case, and if inhibitory neurons' driving force has gone down, then one more thing should happen in these mice, which is that the gamma frequency oscillations, which are not necessarily oscillation, but gamma band power, should reduce. Because the gamma oscillations or gamma power is supposed to arise in the recurrent network of excitatory inhibitory neurons. This is the average power spectrum density. X-axis is frequency. Y-axis is power spectral density, average across all the about 70 or so data sets. Blue is the wild type. Red is the knockout. Theta frequency is more or less the same. There is a slight shift, but that has got to do with small change in running speed. So this is not necessarily significant. Theta power is more or less the same. But at all the values beyond that, power, relative power has gone way down. And notice this, of course, on log scales. So it's pretty large decrement. And that's just the difference between the two end confidence intervals. So one more thing which you would ascribe to hippocampal function, which is this coherent oscillations in high frequency. Several high-profile papers have been published recently showing that how these high-frequency gamma oscillations can play a role in learning and memory. They are actually gone by a substantial amount. In fact, there is nothing significant in these. So almost everything that people in hippocampal field have suggested plays a role in behavior, spatial selectivity, stability of receptive fields, plasticity of receptive field, and certain bursting and high frequency oscillations. They're all messed up in these animals. And still they're able to do this version of tasks. So it's an interesting puzzle, and it gives us some way of getting into what are the mechanisms by which these things arise and what is the role that these things can play. Yes, we did normalize. To low frequency, that's right. Otherwise, the amplitude is all over the place. Because that depends on the electrode impedance and the depth and so on, so we did that. That's just the difference between the power spectra. So showing you on theta band, there is a slight shift, but otherwise there's this huge difference between wild type and knockout at all the bands. And there are fun things there, high frequency gamma, low frequency gamma, and so on, but I'll skip that. So how much time am I left with? Am I out of time? Do I have any minutes? Kind of loose. 15 minutes, good. So then I'll get into some... No. Definitely not 20. So differential contribution of GLUA1 receptors or GLUR1 receptors of AMPA to hippocampal rate and temporal codes and behaviors. So if you remove GLUA1 receptors, there's a large reduction in distal CA3 to CA1 synapses. There's impaired synaptic scaling. There's also impaired inhibitory neuron transmission. But as I said, there's no direct evidence, so we are not emphasizing that too much. But plasticity, which is normal kinds of plasticity, which is relevant for behavior, seems to be intact. There is impaired spatial selectivity in these mice, large reduction of peak firing rates, sparsity, spatial selectivity, variability, experience-dependent plasticity. Everything is messed up by a pretty large amount. This can be explained by some version of winner-take-all model. As a prediction of the model, we predicted that if that's a model, several temporal features should also be messed up, such as gamma frequency, theta phase locking. Actually didn't show you that, but it is true. But we can remove that. Intraburst frequency and theta cycle skipping. So you can explain those things. And based on this, this is the thing that will not let this get published, is that C1 spatial selectivity and gamma oscillations are not required for spatial reference memory, but are required for spatial working memory. That's the conclusion, unfortunately, we have to draw. We didn't want to draw that conclusion. We wanted to see that place cells are important for everything. But that's the way it is. Yeah. Yes, they have been, and they are impaired on that. That's right. They are impaired on that. I'm not sure I understand that. I'm assuming that that signal is not getting stronger or weaker, it's just the distribution of inputs. There is nothing directed about it. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. I'm not sure. I see. That's interesting. Although I'll have to figure out some ways to figure out how to put that into the framework of attention, which goes back to the questions David asked earlier about dopamine and so on. So I'm staying away from that for the time being, because I don't know how to put that in. But it'll be good to talk about it. I'd like to find out what you mean. Yeah. That's right. Although playing a piano is not necessarily hippocampus dependent task, there's a motor skill. That's the basal ganglia thing, but that's right, it could. Our right now, the claim is that the, and this relates to the question that somebody else asked, the claim, our assumption is that if the rats, mice did the same task at the same pace and we saw some differences so that we can compare that the results are due to the whatever cellular changes and not behavior, same things will occur when they are doing something interesting. That they are doing those tasks. Same things will be valid. I don't have any reasons to believe it will not be valid. So if the place fields are impaired in the knockout compared to wild type, now, as somebody was making suggestion, what if we put the mouse in a spatial reference memory task or a spatial working memory task? Maybe these differences will go away. There's no literature that exists that shows that that changes. If you put the rat on a T-maze alternation task, the spatial selectivity is pretty much similar. If you put the rat, which is a working memory task, you put the rat on a spatial reference memory task where you have a cheese board kind of a thing and you hide the food somewhere, the amount of spatial selectivity is not that different. As long as you call it, you make sure the behavior is reasonably controlled. So based on this, my guess is that by doing this experiment where we make sure that the behavior is the same, otherwise we'll be chasing our tails forever, same results will apply for that thing. But that's the assumption. Yeah. Either. There is a paper which is in rats. I would like to still see very carefully, as I mentioned, that we know that spatial selectivity of hippocampus changes as a function of the state of the hippocampus. What's the speed of the rat? What is his head movement? What's his, whether there are sharp waves and so on. So I'd like to make sure those things are the same before I claim that it is or not. Yeah. Yeah. Don't know that. Haven't done that. That's absolutely, that's right. It's interesting, that's right. We haven't done that. Will be interesting thing to try. That's right. Well, no, I won't say it's unique to that. Then I'll have to lesion many, many brain regions to show it's only hippocampus dependent. I don't know that. Can't say that. Yeah? Wrap up? Then part 3 and 4 are over. Thank you.